Welcome to the Augusta Golf Show podcast. Now, here's John Patrick.
Vern Lundquist will be calling his 40th and final Masters this weekend. Through the years, his calls have become part of the rich tradition of that golf tournament. It's a pleasure, a real pleasure, to welcome Vern Lundquist to the Augusta Golf Show for the very first time. How are you, Vern?
Well, I'm better now that we're talking.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for doing this.
Sure.
I imposed on a mutual friend because I really wanted to get the chance to talk to you about a variety of topics. We will get to the Masters, I promise. But let's start with you growing up. Tell me about your childhood. Where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in, we're going way back to the beginning, huh? I was born in Duluth, Minnesota, but I lived there for exactly 3 months, and I've been back exactly once in 83 years.
Mm.
My dad was a Lutheran minister, and he was serving as a student pastor in Duluth for the summer of 1940. And as soon as September came, he enrolled in Lutheran School of Theology in Rock Island, Illinois. So we moved there. Lived in Rock Island for the 4 years that he was in school. Once he was ordained as a Lutheran minister, his first church was in Everett, Washington, about 30 miles north of Seattle. We lived there from the time I was 4 until I was 12. And in the Lutheran church, if you desire to move on, you submit your name to a conference or a committee, and you receive a call. It's a vote of the congregation. And in this case, my dad accepted a call to serve a church in Austin, Texas. So we moved to Austin when I was 12. And essentially, I grew up here. I went through junior high school in Austin. I went away for 4 years to college, but only 50 miles away, Texas Lutheran University. And John Patrick, when I graduated, I had a degree in sociology with a minor in history and no idea what I wanted to do with my life. None.
When somebody asks you where you're from, what do you tell them?
Austin.
Okay.
It's easier than going through the whole itinerary that got me here.
Did you play sports growing up?
I tried to. I was a member of the junior high school basketball team at University Junior High. I was 5'3 in ninth grade, and there was another fellow who's an attorney in Fort Worth now. He was also 5'3, and we have a team photograph. All the ninth graders at that point were between 5'8 and 5'9, and then Terry Gardner and I are the bookends. And here we are, these two seeming midgets at 5'3". Well, I had this gigantic growth spurt when I went into high school at Austin High School. I went to 5'9", which is where I've been now for, 70 years. And I tried to play basketball. I was never big enough for football. I tried, amateur baseball. I like to laugh and say that I had the Pony League strikeout record for the city of Austin. That was as a batter. I struck out 14 times in a row. And when I grounded out to second, I got a standing ovation. So I knew I didn't have a future. In Little League here in Austin, we had two guys who wound up playing in the major leagues. One of whom played 13 years with the Philadelphia Phillies, a guy named Ray Culp. I mean, you got to be my age to remember. And then another guy played a shortstop for them named Danny Cater. But Ray was 5'11 in Little League, and I was 5'3". And he could throw a curveball then, and I couldn't hit a softball. I mean, I was awful. And so I knew I had no future there. I tried basketball, but as a tiny guy, even at 5'9", I couldn't compete with the other guys. And so I dropped out after my from athletics after my sophomore year. And I chose, you know, I was blessed, John Patrick, with my father's voice, the Lutheran minister. So the vocal cords that I've been, that have gotten me into this craft came directly from my dad. And the, so did the belly laugh. He was a big gregarious guy. And because I had an interest in radio television, I did public address at the Austin High School basketball games. And that led to a chance. I also wrote a sports column once a week for the junior high school baseball paper, the high school paper, and my college newspaper. So I dabbled in both ends, print and radio television.
We're talking with Vern Lundquist here on the Augusta Golf Show. Isn't it funny, Vern? I mean, you tell a story similar to mine in that if there was a place where there was a microphone when I was growing up, whether it was calling softball games on a weekend or, to your point, public address at the school, we did it.
Sure. Any opportunity.
So tell me how you got into broadcasting.
Well, I was at Texas Lutheran, and I went all 4 years there. And my junior year, they offered a weekend sport, job. We were sun up to sundown radio station. Mm-hmm. And as a junior, I auditioned for it and lost to another guy. But I decided, well, I really want to do that. So I applied my senior year, and that year I was able to get it. So that was my first reasonably full-time. I was doing Saturday and Sunday. But, you know, I put the station on the air at sunup and took the station off the air at sundown. And I did that my entire senior year. And that really instilled in me a desire to go into this job. Go ahead.
Were you a disc jockey?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, first of all, just for Sunday mornings, for example,
yeah,
I just plugged cords in as I patched one church service after another.
Sure.
Beginning at 7 o'clock in the morning with Catholic Mass, and then we went to the Methodists, the Presbyterians, the Baptists, the Episcopalians, and the Lutherans, of course, or they occupied the 11 o'clock hour. And then I had a disc jockey show in the afternoon from 1 to 5:30 or 6. And I did that my entire senior year.
Did you like being a disc jockey?
Yeah, it was okay. It was only okay.
Okay.
But when I applied for seminary, theological school, and this would have been the fall of 1962, I thought, well, I really enjoyed working in radio. This is a pretty good way to supplement and help me pay for my college, my seminary tuition. So I applied for a job as a summer replacement announcer, and I got it at KROS Radio in Clinton, Iowa, about 30 miles north of the Quad Cities, 30 miles north of Davenport. And I did that Monday through Friday, 4 to midnight. I lived in a YMCA across the street, bathroom down the hall. Cost me $8.50 a week. And then I worked 4 to midnight at the station, which was above a F.W. Woolworth store. I just had to cross the street and go upstairs. And I did that for the summer. And then I applied for a job in Davenport, Iowa, in August of that year, because I was going to move down. Rock Island and Davenport sit on either side of the Mississippi River. And I was going to be in theological school in Rock Island. So I applied for and got a job as a disc jockey again from 9 to midnight, Monday through Friday. And then I'd get up and I worked on the kitchen crew in the morning and then go study Old Testament theology. And I realized, John Patrick, maybe 6 weeks in, that I did not have the dedication and the commitment that was required of that profession. I just didn't feel that strongly. And so I knew I was not going to become a Lutheran minister. But I vowed that I would fulfill the 1 year. And so I did. I have 18 hours of credit at the Lutheran School of Theology from the year 62 to 63, and including 3 hours of Greek.
Oh, look at you.
Which has, yeah, smell me, huh? It hasn't come in particularly helpful in this craft that I've followed.
How was your dad when you switched paths?
Well, I shared a story. While I was in theological school, knowing that I didn't want to come back, I applied for a job in Austin, my hometown, at KTVC AM/FM television. And I was hired as a summer replacement announcer on FM radio, playing soft music, you know, easy listening music. And I worked Monday through Friday replacing disc jockeys on vacation. And that summer, which would have been the summer of 63, the sports job opened up. Now, keep in mind, I had written these columns and did public address at sports events. I really loved athletic competition, even though I couldn't accomplish it as an athlete. And so I thought, I'm not going back to school. I'm going to apply for this job. I talked to the program director, who's a legendary guy, passed away about 10 years ago here. He said, not bad. And here's how primitive this business was. There was no videotape, no color television. Mm. So I did the audition live into a camera, and then they were watching in a viewing room upstairs, and I was offered a weekend job and fill in the rest of the Monday through Friday with a disc jockey job from 5 to 9. So that's how I started in September of 1963. And that lasted for 6 months. They had hired another guy. He didn't work out. And they came to me and said, you promise us you're not going back to theological school. I said, no, I'm not. Would you like to have this job full time? And that's how I got it. The story you asked about my dad, and times were a lot different back then in terms of quid pro quo stuff. My dad, when I told him I was going to stay in Austin working sports television, he said, do you get any perks? And I said, well, I get 4 tickets to the Longhorn home games. And my father said, with his impish grin, well, the Lord does work in mysterious ways.
So he was fine with your choice.
Oh, yeah. He knew.
Yeah.
He knew that in my heart, I didn't have the same kind of dedication that he had. So
now,
he was very comfortable with it.
I want to skip a little bit ahead, because some people may not realize, from what I saw, late 60s, you're the radio voice for the Cowboys, for the Dallas Cowboys.
Yeah.
So you've got Landry and Bob Hayes and Meredith. So tell me about those times. What was that like?
Well, that really... if I look back on the career that now stretches over 60 years, getting the Cowboy radio job was the key to everything.
Mm.
Everything. I moved to Dallas at the ABC affiliate in 1967. I'd been in Austin for 3 years, San Antonio for a year, got the job in Dallas. And the first week I was there, Tex Schramm, the legendary general manager of the Cowboys, called me and he said, "Would you like to? We like having our local on the air sports guys as part of the broadcast if we can. Would you like to join us as the pregame, postgame, and halftime host?" And I said, "You darn right I do." So in that capacity, I was present in 1967, December 31st, at the Green Bay-Dallas famous Ice Bowl game.
Mm-hmm.
And had a chance to do an interview with Vince Lombardi. And, of course, Bart Starr, those who don't remember, it was 13 below zero when it started. It was 20 below when the game ended. And it ended when Bart Starr had a quarterback sneak from 1 yard line with no timeouts left. And Green Bay won 21-17. But that was my first year, pre and post. I did pre and post for 2 years. The color analyst for the broadcast then was a legendary sports columnist for Dallas Times Herald and the Dallas Morning News, guy named Blackie Sherrod. He decided he didn't want to travel anymore. I was promoted to the color commentator alongside a man named Bill Mercer, who is still living. Bill is 98 and lives north of Dallas. And I did that with Bill for a couple of years. And then Bill had always wanted to be a sports radio play-by-play guy in Major League Baseball. And when the Washington Senators relocated to Arlington and became the Texas Rangers, Bill took that job. And that opened up the play-by-play. Tex came to me and he said, "I'm going to put you in the play-by-play job." And I said, "Tex, I want to do it, but you need to know that I've never done play-by-play in my life." And he said, "I understand, but I think you could do it." My first game as a play-by-play guy was the old college all-star game. The Cowboys had won the Super Bowl the previous year, 72, and they played the college all-stars in Chicago. And I did that. That was the start of it. And that Cowboy play-by-play job led to everything else, everything.
We're talking with Vern Lundquist here on the Augusta Golf Show. So when did the networks start calling?
Well, I had an offer 2 years in, would have been 74. I had an offer to go to KNXT in Los Angeles. CBS owned and operated, second largest market in the country. And I flew out to L.A., and the program director, a guy named Bill Ames, offered me the job Monday through Friday, 6 and 11, as a sports director. And I said, "I really want to do this." And he said, "Good, we have a verbal agreement. I'll send you the contract." And so I was ready to go. And I came back. I can remember this like it was yesterday. I flew back from Los Angeles to Old Love Field in Dallas, hopped off of a Braniff Airlines plane, went down to the end of the corridor, hopped on the Cowboy charter to go to New Orleans for Super Bowl VI. And on the way down, I sat with Tex, and I told him I had this offer to go to Los Angeles. And he said, "Have you signed anything yet?" "No, I haven't." And he said, "Don't. I want to have lunch with you." So when the Super Bowl was over, he and I had an NFL named Al Ward, he's the number two guy, had lunch that lasted 4 hours, during which time Tex said, "Listen, we're going to be, what do you want to do in 10 years? I said, "I want to do network play-by-play." He said, "Well, we're going to be pretty good. If you'll turn down that L.A. job, stay in Dallas, I promise you, if you can do what I think you can do, the networks will find you. You won't have to go after them." And that is exactly what happened. So I turned down Los Angeles, took the Cowboy job, and 2 years later, I got a call from ABC with an offer of a small schedule of football games.
Now, I don't want to hurt your feelings, Vern. But when I saw the ABC portion of your resume, I don't remember you on ABC. I'm sorry. I remember Jim McKay. I remember Kress Schenkel. You know, I remember the Love Theme Orchestra for the golf coverage. But Vern, what'd you do at ABC?
Well, I did, as a matter of fact, I did boxing. I had three events in three months, and this was my last year. I was there from 74 to 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, my first ever telecast was Kent State at Ohio University. No, other way around. Ohio University at Kent State. There was a graduate assistant on the Kent State staff of whom you might have heard. His name was Nick Saban.
Yeah, names come up a couple of times.
Yeah, I thought perhaps. Well, Nick and I have become really good friends over the years, 17 years of doing the SEC. And we used to love to laugh about how I would say, Nick, I remember seeing you in the adjacent press box on the headset, and I thought, that guy's going to be a great head coach. He said, yeah, I remember looking at you and thinking, the guy's going to be a success as a network commentator. Well, that's all BS. we've had fun with it. And I got to know him very, very, very well. And I'm not surprised that he retired, given the transfer portal. And that's a whole different story.
How did the move to CBS happen?
Well, you said you didn't remember what I did at ABC.
Yeah, I didn't. I'm sorry.
Apparently, ABC didn't really appreciate what I did.
Okay.
Among the other things, I did work as a sideline reporter with Jim McKay. He was my idol. And Jim McKay and a guy named a Brit, because you always had to have a Brit on soccer telecast.
Okay.
A guy named Paul Gardner. Jim McKay, Paul Gardner in the booth. I was the sideline guy for 2 years on the North American Soccer League. But that was, I did maybe 10 golf tournaments. That was about it.
Yeah. Did you do any Wide World of Sports?
Yeah, I was on Channel 8 in Dallas the whole time. At one point.
No, did you, on the network, on the network of ABC, did you do any Wide World of Sports telecasts?
Oh, yeah, I did.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Did a couple. I did a boxing match. I did one in Tokyo, one in Moscow in 1980. That was a kick,
wow.
Let me tell you.
Wow.
And I did one in Schwerin, East Germany. First live telecast out of East Germany. And this was the height of the Cold War. I had a driver and a translator combination pick me up in Berlin. We went through Checkpoint Charlie and got on a straight road to Schwerin up near the Baltic for 120 miles. And we were there for a week. And then when we came back through Checkpoint Charlie at 3 o'clock in the morning. There were four of us then in the car. I'd gone up solo, and our producer and director came back with me. And John Patrick, I can still vividly remember when we came through Checkpoint Charlie. They were checking under the car to see if we were sneaking anybody out, the Vopo, the East Germans. And when we went through Checkpoint Charlie and got to West Berlin, it was like a light show had gone off. You know, all of a sudden there was neon and instead of gray and black, and it was just dark. Yeah. So I had some adventures.
I'll say.
But at the end of 1980, I got a call from Chuck Howard, who was a vice president of programming at ABC Sports. He said the proverbial thing that happens to most of us at one point: we're moving in a different direction.
Did you tell him you could go in that direction, Vern?
Yeah, I said, hey, what, you want me to do swimming and diving? I can do that. Figure skating? I can do that.
That's not what they mean, Vern.
No, I get it. So here I was about to get married, remarried. My wife Nancy and I had met in 1980. We got married in 82. I was out of a network job. I still had the local ABC sports thing. And then I had a friend who had been a producer at ABC, and he had made the jump to CBS. And he called and said, I know what happened to you at ABC. I know you want to keep going with networks. Maybe you could come over here somehow. Well, this is, in my view, an intriguing part of the story. I was working at an ABC affiliate. My boss was a guy named Dave Lane, from whom I had never hid my desire to go to a network. I went in to see Dave. He was a sportscaster. He had beaten me out for the job in Dallas 6 years earlier. I said, Dave, I've got this little mini offer from CBS. Can you possibly see your way clear to let me pursue this and remain on the air at this ABC affiliate? Because I needed to earn a living. And he said, okay, think about the magnanimity of this guy and what he did for me.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I can't have you as a staff employee. So you're going to resign, sign an independent contractor with us, the status. You'll get paid when you're here, and you won't get paid on days you miss because of CBS, and none of your telecast can be televised in the Dallas-Fort Worth market, which precluded any national telecast.
Right.
But I jumped at it, and I did. Oh, gosh, I can't remember that first year. It was a guarantee for 6 football and 2 basketball. And they liked what I did. So the football games became like 10. Basketball games became, I don't know, 10 or 12. And it was fairly obvious that if I kept going in that direction, I might have a shot at a full-time job. And the signal event in my CBS career occurred on December 1st of 82. I'd started out doing college football. Then I switched to, anyway, before I switched to the NFL, I got a call from Frank Cherkinian, executive producer of golf.
I knew that name would come up.
I had to. Had to. The Ayatollah.
Yep.
Did you ever know Frank, John Patrick?
I did know Frank, and honestly, Jim gives me a hard time, Vern, because I did the last interview with Frank before he passed away, and I knew wow. He was ill. I didn't know he was that ill. And Jim's like, you know, John, I did the last one with Arnold. You did the last one with Frank.
Wow.
He was so incredibly gracious to me, Vern. He just, you know, he would live here from time to time when he was married to MJ.
Yep.
But he could not have been nicer to me.
Well, that's great. And in truth, me too. It's just that we all feared him.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Respected him. But my God, the Ayatollah.
In 16 years of doing this show, you know, with the guests that I've had, Vern, I do get people on the street say, now, which guest has made you the most nervous? And I'm like, you might not know that. You may not know his name. Who? I said, a fellow by the name of Frank Cherkinian. What?
Yep.
Here's the thing. If I asked a stupid question or an inane question, he was going to tell me.
Amen.
But well, I loved him. But I loved him.
And I did, too. A lady from CBS programming named Susan Arani called me on December 1st of 1982. And Nancy and I were living, my wife and I were living in a suburb of Dallas-Fort Worth. And I had started this little adventure of doing some work for CBS. And she called and she said, have you ever done golf? And I said, yeah, I did probably 10 events at ABC. You know, I got to work with Byron Nelson and Chris Schenkel and Jim McKay and that whole Dave Marr.
Mm-hmm.
I've done about 10. And she said, well, our executive producer of golf, Frank Cherkinian, really likes your work, and he's going to call you. So Frank called that night, and he said, okay, Lundquist, here are your assignments. You're going to do Pebble Beach, Jack's Tournament, Byron Nelson, Colonial, and, oh, by the way, Augusta. Well, and then he said, I don't want you to meet our guys cold. He said, so I want you to work the Phoenix Open as your first event. It's on opposite the Super Bowl, so nobody's going to watch it. But you'll have a chance to introduce yourself to our crew. I knew most of them from, you know, when they were in Dallas or Fort Worth. But I mean, honest to God, I showed up at Phoenix with Nancy, and here's Ken Venturi and Pat Summerall, 18. Ben Wright, Tom Weisskopf at 17.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working 16. Steve Melnick is at 15. And I thought, this is the big time. And it went well. And then after we got through Augusta, I'd worked the 13th hole at Augusta in 83. And it went so well that those six tournaments that first year became 17 golf tournaments.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, at the end of the year, I had a feeling that I was going to get a call. And so at the age of 42, I got my first network full-time job. And it was all because of my involvement in golf and Frank Cherkinian's belief in me.
What do you remember about the Masters and those early days, Vern?
How different it is now.
Mm.
Just, you know, I'm trying to, I never knew Clifford Roberts, the first chairman.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've met every chairman since then, 83. And I just thought the regimen, the dictates were very, I mean, Clifford Roberts was a dictator. And what, you know, he founded Augusta with Bobby Jones. And he laid down the rules, and you didn't violate them at all. And you remember famously Jack Whitaker referred to the gallery around 18 as a mob.
Right.
And he was banned from Augusta. And so, hey, it's the best run tournament in the world. Absolutely. It's in my view, the greatest tournament in the world because it is played unlike the Open or the U.S. Open or the PGA, which are rotating. Every year you go back to Augusta, people in the world know the golf course. And so having worked 39 of them and getting ready now to work my 40th, it's a huge, huge part of my life. But I remember those early days. You walked, you didn't step beyond the lines at all. Hey, if they want them to call, if Augusta National, the membership, wants us to call them patrons, it's their tournament. We'll call them patrons. If they don't like the word rough, they want second cut, it's their tournament. It's not a big thing, really. And people say, well, don't they give it to you the rules and regulations? Let me dispel that theory. We sit down. We have a meeting with Augusta National membership. It'll happen on Wednesday morning this year. That always does. You know what we do? We go over with Toby Keith, who's the announcer on the first hole. We check pronunciations. And then usually Fred Ridley, who's now the chairman, will come in. Just it's a greet and meet. I mean, meet and greet. He wants to know, you know, and we have a great relationship. The one I know better than any of them is Billy Payne. And Billy is part of a group of 15 guys, all of whom are members of Augusta National, who formed a group about 8, 9, 10 years ago and bought a fishing and established a fishing camp.
I've heard about
Have
this.
You heard about
I've heard about this place, Vern.
Oh, baby. It is something. It's in Steamboat on either side of the Yampa River. They've got, and Nancy and I know, of the 15 members, I think we know 8 or 9. And we were good friends with all of them, and the ones we know. But Billy started it, it was Billy's idea. He put the group together, and they have this. It's just an amazing place. They have a main house that has 7 bedrooms. They've got 2 lodges on either side, 3 bedrooms each. Each member gets 1 week in the winter, 1 in the summer. And then they somehow divide them up, and then the weeks that are not bid upon, you can open, let the other members know, hey, I want to go back there, and it's open year round. They have a full time staff.
I've seen photographs. It looks spectacular.
Oh, it is spectacular. It's 2 miles off the state highway, back hidden. The ironic thing, and they hired Tom Fazio to build a 6-hole golf course.
Of course they did.
And, of course. And Tom built 6 holes, and it has 3 tees each, so you can imagine you're playing 18 holes. And that is a beautiful, beautiful. Matter of fact, I got a call last week, John Patrick, from one of my best friends with Bill Raftery, who was in Jupiter, Florida with Tom Fazio. So I talked to both of them just a week ago.
I have to ask you about 1986. And you hadn't done, to your point, you hadn't done many Masters by 86.
No.
Take me back to that Sunday. Take me back to some of that. I know you've been asked a billion times about the call on 17.
Of course.
Yeah.
I could almost go through every stroke. There's a wonderful story about our coverage of Jack Nicklaus during that magical Sunday. He had had a really, he started the day 4 back of Seve Ballesteros, and he had a mundane first 8 holes, and we didn't cover the front 9 back then. We could cover 9 by turning a camera around in the 18th tower, and they could see, C9. Frank Chinnium was the producer. Lance Barrow, who succeeded him, was the associate producer. Lance was a large man, large, north of 300 pounds. And Frank called him Buddha. That was his nickname. So here comes Jack, and Jack birdies 9. And Lance said, Frank, we've got Nicklaus with a birdie on 9. And Chikinian turned around to Lance and said, Buddha, listen to me, and listen to me well. We tell stories on this telecast, and Jack Nicklaus is not part of his story. So he goes to 10. He birdies 10. Buddha, Lance, screws his courage up. He said, Frank, we get Jack with a birdie on 10. And all Chikinian did was turn around and glare at him. Didn't say a word. Now he birdies 11. Frank and Jack has now birdied 3 in a row. And Chikinian has said to him, I heard this from Lance. He turned around and said, well, all right. So they went back, and on tape they replayed 9, 10, and 11. And I'll guarantee you, Jack didn't take a step after that on the second 9. That was not documented on CBS. And, he had a stumble. Let's see if I can remember now.
On 12. He bogeyed 12. He bogeyed 12.
Bogeyed 12. Yep. He birdies 13. He parred 14. He eagled 15. He almost had an ace at 16. That was Jim Nance's first Masters telecast.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim had a great line. The bear has come out of hiding. Hibernation.
Yep.
And so now he's standing at the tee at 17 where I was. And he doesn't know this, but Seve puts it in the water at 15. Jack hits his tee shot, and he hooked it and pulls it way left over near the seventh green. And now Seve, as Jack stands over his second shot 125 yards out, Seve is struggling back two holes behind him. Jack puts it 12 feet above the hole, and as he does that, Seve finishes with a 7 on the 15th hole. They are now tied for the lead. And I can remember like it was yesterday, as Jack is walking up toward the green, I said to myself, keep it simple and get out of the way. And now he stands, and again, John Patrick, I've seen this 4,000 times, I think. He stands over the putt, and all I said was, this is for sole possession of the lead. And then he, you know, had that little subtle double break. And it, I said, maybe, and yes, sir, with a little more enthusiasm than that. And he took the lead. And I have, you can't afford to be an autograph seeker doing what we do. But that was special. So I know a friend who is a, plays golf with Jack a lot, and he said, you got to get a photo of that moment. So I do have that in my office at Steamboat Springs. It's Jack with the putter raised, the famous shot, and he signed it.
You know, do you think, Vern, I've never thought of this, but as you tell that story, it strikes me. If you look back on that, and I'm not taking anything away from what you did on that call, but if you had not had Frank Cherkinian and his philosophy of covering a golf tournament the way he wanted covered, can you attribute some of the way you did that to Frank?
Oh, gosh, yes. Oh, gosh, yes. Discipline. He famously said to all of us, you're caption writers. Don't tell me what I can see. Tell me what I can't see. And I learned that. That was drilled into me at the Phoenix Open, the very first tournament I ever did. Yeah. He was, listen, the Ayatollah was a terrific, and he produced and directed. He sat in both chairs. And but he taught discipline. And you lead me into an anecdote about the aftermath of that call.
Mm-hmm.
Neil Pilson was, at the time at 17, we were 20 feet up, and there was a wide open platform on the top. There were three people on there, George Rothweiler, the main cameraman, me, and Neil Pilson, the president of CBS. No phones at Augusta except for the president of CBS. He had a dial phone up there, and in between groups on the green, he'd be making phone calls. And I thought, boy, he knows people. But when the tournament ended, and remember now, Jack had to win it,
right.
Two guys had a chance, Kite and
Norman
and Greg Norman,
yeah,
both had a chance. And when we got down in the cart, Neil rode back to me to the compound, and. Well, we drove over the compound, got out of the cart, and Cherkinian was there. And he came over and gave me a hug and kissed me on the cheek. And that might be the greatest compliment I've ever received in all the years I've done sports broadcasting.
I understand.
That meant so much to me. Oh, boy.
Since we're talking your calls, I'm going to stick with golf for a second. Let me move up 20 years. It's 2005. You're on 16. Tigers to the left of the green. Take me through some of those moments.
Well, he pulls an 8-iron long and left, inexplicably almost. And so he's on the fringe. Lanny Watkins was in the tower at 18, and like Drew and Jack's call, I've seen the Tiger chip shot a thousand times. And Lanny, his fellow competitor was Chris DeMarco. And Chris was about 20 feet below the hole. And Lanny said on the air, I said, what do you think here? And he said, he'll be lucky from where he is to get it inside DeMarco's ball. And so he hits the chip, and, you know, he hit it just perfectly. One bounce, and it spun to a stop, and then it starts tumbling. He was 25 feet left of the hole. And then it starts tumbling down toward the hole. And I said what I said, and it hung on the lip of the cup for 1.8 seconds. And then dropped in. Now, in the front of the truck at that point was the producer, Lance Barrel, the director, Steve Milton, who still does all of our golf, and the technical director, Norm Patterson. He's to the right. And the way this works, the talent is in touch with the producer mostly. We don't hear the director. Steve has 54 cameras. He's trying to call out camera shots. And then when he executes, when he says a camera shot, he gives the command, and he says, ready 10, take 10. And 10, in this case, is the guy with me in the tower at 16, a fellow who's retired now named Bob Wishney. And then when he says, ready 10, take 10, Norm Patterson, sitting to his right, punches a button, and you see 10 on your living rooms at home. And that's what happened in this case. Ready 10, take 10. So it's Bob Wishney's shot as the ball comes up, and Wishney had a, you know, focus was great, and he never lost focus. Now the ball turns and tumbles down, and if it gets, maybe 2 feet from the cup, Steve says, ready 6, take 6. 6 is a flanker camera over to my left from the tower. And he's up on a pedestal, and his command is to take a reaction shot of Tiger. So he's got his shoulders to the top of his head. Ready 6, take 6. Norm Patterson followed his instincts. It's a fireable offense, much like disobeying the orders of a captain on the bridge of a ship. He followed his instincts. He did not take 6. He stayed with 10. And that's why you saw the ball drop. And it changes everything about our memory of that occasion. Because, yes, you would have heard the roar, but you would have been watching Tiger's reaction. You would not have seen the ball drop.
Boy, that's a great story. That's a great story.
Vern,
we were watching in the media center. I'm just curious if you remember back in real time. You could see the ball oscillating. You know, it wasn't, there was still movement. Did you get a sense, holy cow, this is going to fall in?
Not immediately.
Okay.
No. And the reason I know it's 1.8 is because I've timed it. and it's so much funny, so much fun, John Patrick. Nike did a commercial.
Right.
You know, a month or two later. And the tagline was, Tiger, next time at least get the logo straight. and you know, much like the Jack Nicklaus photograph, I'm not an autograph collector, but I called Mark Steinberg, who was Tiger's agent. And I said, Mark, you get 1,000 requests, but I think you'll consider this one special. That was an amazing moment. And Mark said, I agree. Send me the photograph. And so I've got Tiger's signature as well.
Yeah.
So those are the two that I keep in my office. And those are all going to, when we pass, all my memorabilia and stuff is going to my alma mater.
Good for you.
Texas Lutheran.
Good for you.
And And those two photographs will be a part of the thing that will go to TLU.
Now, people may not remember, and I hate saying it that way, but you also, it wasn't just golf. You had Duke, Kentucky, 92.
Yep.
East Regional Finals, Christian Laettner. I know all of these calls are probably like your children. Which one of those three was the most exciting for you?
I would think Tiger. Okay. Although it's a generational thing with me. You know, Jack is 6 months older than I am.
Mm-hmm.
A fact about which I never tire of reminding him. But if you think back, I'd say a tie between the two. Listen, the Christian Laettner call, you go to a game, you hope something happens in front of you that is memorable, and then you hope that you're verbally able to punctuate it with, hey, that one, I just channeled my inner Marv Albert. you know, when Laettner's ball went in, I just screamed, yes! It was Marv Albert Redux. And so of the three, that was the most thrilling basketball game. It's still regarded by many as the best game ever played.
Yeah.
I would concur. 104-103 in overtime. But I'm fonder of both Jack and Tiger than I am of the Laettner shot.
You know, I need to ask you a couple of questions about this. You are beloved in this part of the country. Yes, for the Masters stuff, but for SEC football on CBS.
Sure.
What was it like watching that conference come to prominence in college football?
Well, you know, we took the chance with the SEC in 96. I started in 2000. Sean McDonough, Jim Nance did it 1 year,
mm-hmm.
The SEC, and Sean McDonough was my predecessor. And but you take what essentially is a regional sport and you give it a national spotlight, and CBS, Sean McManus, Jim McKay's son, my boss, who's retiring at the end of the Masters this year, he and I are going out together. But Sean took a chance on the SEC, thinking it would grow into prominence. And, of course, it is. I mean, I'm prejudiced, right? I did this for 17 years. But I think it's hands down the best conference in the country. And I know the coaches. I mean... Just as an example, I know Nick really well.
Mm-hmm.
Kirby Smart is a friend of mine, and not parenthetically, but honest to God, I heard yesterday. Maybe do you know Lauren Smith, John Patrick?
I know Lauren very well.
Okay, he is a dear. He and Myrna are dear friends of Nancy's and mine, and I heard from him yesterday because on Tuesday of this year. Lauren and Myrna, Nancy and me, and Bill and Lynn Griffin are going to have dinner together at the Trophy Club at Augusta National.
Good.
That forget what Jim Nance says. This dinner is a tradition unlike any other.
You know, when I told somebody in the hallways that you and I were going to speak today, they wanted to make sure I said to you, you are missed on those telecasts.
Well... And it was a huge part of my life. Huge.
How much college football do you watch now?
All of it.
Okay.
I'm addicted, and I don't watch the NFL that much. But no, I'm up at 10 o'clock. We're usually in Colorado at the time, and I start at 10 in the morning, and I finish with whatever is the last game on. And when they print the list of announcers, they publish. I print it out so I can go back and forth and channel hop, and I watch it from mid morning to late night, and I'm not that much of an NFL fan, but I am addicted to college football.
Give me just a sense, Vern, of how special Army Navy is.
The best.
Yeah.
I got to do 11 of them. And that was my last game in 06. And I just I get it, I think. I get it. I mean, my military obligation was fulfilled in the United States Air Force Reserve, which is a far, far cry from what these men and women are given to our country. And part of the routine during the week is you visit both West Point and Annapolis, and you get to meet these young men and women, and you get a sense of their what they're doing for their country and the obligations that they and they're they literally are putting themselves in harm's way. And to a man and woman, they are just exemplary citizens of this country. And to get to know them, and you get to know the coaches. I'm lucky. I count Ken Niumatalolo as a good friend, Navy coach for years and years and years. I don't know the Army personnel that well, but we would go to West Point. We'd go to West Point, and then we'd go West Point, then the Naval Academy, and then wherever the game was. And it's on a rotating basis.
Yeah.
Usually in Philadelphia. My last game was in Baltimore. And it's my favorite game of the year.
Before I let you go, and I was going to ask you specific favorite football player, basketball player, golf. I don't want to do that. That maybe seems unfair. But in your history of doing sports, Vern, can you choose one athlete that you'll never forget?
Roger Staubach.
Really?
Yeah, because we became friends again. It goes to a different level, I think. Roger and Marianne, his wife, and Nancy and I used to have dinner once a year. They live in Dallas, of course. We have a second home where I'm talking to you now. We live in Steamboat Springs, Colorado. We're there 70% of the year, but we're in Austin, Texas, 30% of the year. And so we're in and out of Dallas a lot. Roger and Marianne live in Dallas. They have a second home about at a lake resort about 60 miles north of where we are. And we used to get together once a year. They're an amazing couple of kids. He's 1 year, 1 year younger than I am. But they've raised five children. They have a huge family, grandchildren, great-grandchildren now. Mm. One of their daughters, Jennifer, served for years on the Dallas City Council. And they're just an amazing family. Everything that's right about this country, Roger and Marianne, and their children and grandchildren are.
Since stepping aside, for the most part, what do you miss the most?
The actual game day experience. There's so much more prep. Even people might think, well, how do you prep for golf? Well, you prep by doing what I do every Saturday and Sunday now. I learn about Jake Knapp and Matthew Pavon.
Right.
And you know, I mean, I'm addicted to golf coverage too, because I got to know these guys.
Yeah.
When I get to Augusta, and you know, it's funny now. They're two generations removed from me, and so I don't know them personally like I did the guys of my generation,
sure.
And indeed the one that followed us. So I'll share with you something. I've got a mission at Augusta this year.
Mm-hmm.
I've never met Scotty Scheffler. I'm going to go to the practice range of the putting green, and I'm going to walk up and introduce myself. I need to know this guy.
Yeah.
Because from everything I've heard, he is an extraordinary human being. I'd like to shake his hand.
Well, yeah, you should. You should know Scotty. Let me get you in trouble with the last question. College football. who has the best, and the pomp and circumstance of college football is just glorious. Who has the best pregame celebration?
Oh, gosh. Best pregame celebration. Well, LSU's pretty darn good. But they hate, LSU hates it when CBS picks the game because we cut into their drinking time.
he is Vern Lundquist. Vern will be at the Masters. From what we hear, for the 40th and final time. I kind of hope it's not the last time. Vern, I cannot thank you enough for saying yes to this. You stayed way longer than I thought you would. Scotty, I owe Scotty big time. Vern, thank you. Thank you for doing this.
John Patrick, it was my privilege. I enjoyed it very, very much.